Andrew, are you there?
I am here. I am seated. I'm ready.
Okay, so I'm glad that we're connecting, because I'm not sure if the internet is going to hold up for the entire time that I'm on this call. So we have to get through things as quickly as possible. So we're going to make this normally 2-hour podcast into roughly an hour and 58 minutes.
This is easily the most precarious podcasting tandem that we've done so far.
All right. So what's your situation right now? Because I'm interested in your new life, your new life information here.
Just a laptop on a dining room table with my microphone on a very shoddy, like, plastic tripod stand. My internet is fantastic, though. I've got 300 megabits sequential. So if there are any issues in our connection, it is all you.
It's all me. Okay, that's why. And the reason is because, and the reason I haven't been on the podcast for the last 2 weeks, I'm in Turkey right now. And I'm not just in Turkey, like Istanbul or Ankara, Turkey. I'm in this tiny little town in the southwest of the country called Çandarlı. I have only a 3G connection.
Oh my goodness, really?
Yeah, and I'm actually doing pretty well. This 3G connection does 15 up and 8 down. So I'm sorry, 15 down and 8 up. So I'm actually not like doing too terrible when it comes to bandwidth, but we'll see how this goes. And for anybody kind of following my Instagram and my Twitter, I'm here for 5 weeks overall. This is almost the end of the third week.
Feels like you've been gone forever, to be honest.
It actually does. This has been a very strange trip. And maybe if we have a bit of time at the end, I'd love to tell you about the trip itself, you being the people listening, and you, Andrew, because we haven't caught up enough. But I want to tell people about all the travel gear that I brought with me that keeps me connected, all the redundancy that I needed to ensure I had to prevent my work life from falling apart, because I'm doing my job, and it's hard when you're not in an office. Like, we take for granted that even though we work remotely, it's hard not having a place to go every day, even if place is like the same Starbucks you go to every morning.
And we think about how, you know, you don't realize that you actually need a fair bit of gear until it's taken away from you. And it's not just sitting on a desk or in, you know, a set of drawers or something in the corner, you know, and totally, it's packed away. And in my case, it's like 1,000 miles away in a storage unit. You know, it's just impossible to get to. And then you're like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to Best Buy today to buy a bunch of cables.
Right. And hopefully not monster cables.
No,
never. All right. So let's start with the show, because there's so much to talk about this week. It's kind of overwhelming. And the first thing that I think I want to talk about is this weird tweet that Niantic put out over the last couple of days, which just kind of got me thinking. And the tweet was basically like, it was so innocuous and so nothing, but it kind of got me thinking.
Okay, I can read it here if you want me to.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, it says, Android users, Ingress and Pokemon Go will be discontinuing support for Android 4 after July 1. We encourage you to update the operating systems to Android 5 or above for uninterrupted access. And then I said, what year is it?
Okay, first, yes, what year is it? Because KitKat came out in like 2013. But also, it's like, you know, this tweet was supposed to be very, you know, it was not obviously run through somebody who understands Android very well, but it was just meant to be like, listen, if you're running a really old phone, just upgrade your phone. Upgrade the software, upgrade the hardware, just get rid of this ancient operating system version. But it got me thinking, like, a lot of people who use Android phones don't really understand the way updates work. And they take for granted that, hey, if my phone is running KitKat, which is still like 7% of 2.5 billion users, which is a lot of people, they may think, you know, oh, I'm a Pokemon Go user, I can just update my phone by going to like the settings, software update, and getting Lollipop, which is Android 5. And nobody in the world in our, you know, the year of our Lord 2019 is going to be able to do that.
There was nobody that is using that game or in general using something that old that has just been putting off their update to Android 5. And that's why it seems you want to say tone deaf, but it's not that. It's just like not reading the room at all, not understanding the situation. And I just don't understand what the overlap is between people that are potentially seeing this like PSA from Niantic and people who are aware of the situation, like what's required to just buy a new phone.
Yeah, but I also just got to thinking that there are so many people who have Android phones who don't understand the update process and who either don't want updates because it'll mess up this like tightrope of an experience that they have cobbled together. Because often when I see especially older people's Android phones, it's this like weird hybrid of the default settings and home screen and apps that they got when they bought the phone. And then a couple of things that they've like been hesitant to download, but somebody got them in, you know, somebody put that app on their home screen and they started using it. And like, I'm speaking out of experience here because my mom is like a perfect example of this. She has a BlackBerry Key 2, and she loves the phone, but the apps that she uses and the experience that she has on a Key 2 is very different from the experience that I would have or Jerry would have on a Key 2. And like, she doesn't update her phone. She doesn't know what that means. Even if she gets an update notification, she's never going to tap on it.
Yeah,
because to her, that's actually a bad thing. It could like ruin her her overall comfort with the interface or whatever.
And that typically comes from experience as well. It's not uncommon for people to have a disdain for what updates do, not just for the times when they do kind of just screw things up or they cause problems, but just fear of the unknown and the change of things. I see this all the time on my family's Android phones. They sit there for months and months with an update pending because they just don't want to deal with it or think about it because they've had a previous update that screwed it up or something. And then eventually it goes away because they stop offering it.
Yeah. And I think there's also this disconnect between people who have Android phones but are aware of the way that iPhone updates work in popular culture because they're much more mainstream. And that expectation that if you buy an iPhone, you're going to get updates for X number of years and everybody gets the update on the same day. And if there's a screw up, you'll read about it on BuzzFeed or your kid or your, you know, friend will tell you about it. And that's just a thing that happens. Whereas when Android updates are released, it's always at different times, depending on your phone. And, you know, it's much more difficult to build a cohesive narrative around updates. And I wrote this piece because I feel so much empathy for people who could be Pokemon Go obsessed and may get completely confused about this. And even if it's just a couple thousand people who are like, oh, I got to update my phone to Android 5 Lollipop tomorrow. And then only to realize that, no, you actually have to go out and buy a new phone and relive the torture of having to figure out everything about your phone all over again. Because for people who don't love doing that, it's a serious source of anxiety. It's not something that they look forward to.
And the interesting thing in this particular case, because you're talking about something that's so old, is they're not actually going to see any relevant or recent resources for it. So they're going to be double confused because it's not actually something that happened in the last 5 years.
Right. And I mean, we get these emails all the time into our inbox, mainly because people confuse Android Central with like Android, Google's Android. And we get people complaining about updates that their phones receive, usually Samsung updates, because if there's one like environment where people get updates around the same time and it's a significant number of people and it's a big deal, it's Samsung phones. So, you know, we usually get like, hey, my phone got updated from Marshmallow to Nougat or Nougat to Oreo or something like that. Oreo, you know, the Nougat to Oreo update was a big deal and introduced a lot of bugs and problems for people. We got so many emails about that update from people who were disgruntled just by these minor changes that Samsung really didn't take into account when they released this big update. I mean, you know, the individual text tones
per contact or per thread was like thousands of emails.
So many emails. And like, I just feel bad for people because they don't understand it. And I just wish that there was a way for Google to take control over the situation. And then in the last part of my piece, I talk about, you know, Project Mainline and Treble and how Google is doing as much as it possibly can to, you know, automate this update process. But by and large, it's still not going to take it over and control it the way that Apple does on iPhone and Windows and Microsoft does on Windows.
But in some ways that can, like something like Project Mainline and faster compartmentalized updates with Treble can cut both ways, because you're really just talking about speeding up the process of, you know, inducing anxiety for people around updates.
Yeah.
So you're saying, you hate the process of features changing without you really knowing what's going on. How about we do that every 2 months for you? How would you like that? And then some people are really not going to be interested in that.
Or they're just never going to update and they're going to have those notifications sitting there for months and years because it's safer than taking the chance and making the leap. So anyway, I mean, this is not going away. It's getting better. I'm really interested to see what Project Mainline does in Q, but it'll be many, many years until that has an impact on a significant number of Android users, because it's, you need Android Q for Project Mainline to be a thing. And that's if you're not familiar with it, it's where you get some portions of your software of the Android operating system update through the Play Store. And it allows Google to sort of push those major features through the Play Store rather than waiting for these carrier or OEM specific OTAs. So, yeah, I mean, really interesting week we've had. That was just one of many things. Do you want to talk about Huawei for a second?
I mean, it's worth noting in the update discussion here that they're just trucking along. They're saying, hey, we're just going to continue to update things, which we didn't even think was possible, right?
Right. So this week, Huawei releases a statement, titled "Our Commitment to You." At Huawei, we put our customers first, regardless of the challenges we face. It's like, you know, they're going up against the big beast of the U.S. government. And they're saying, you know, anyone who has already bought or is about to buy, and that's especially important because, just the narrative around, like, should you buy a Huawei phone or is about to buy a Huawei phone, can continue to access the world of apps as they have always done. All Huawei smartphones and tablets will continue to receive security patches and updates. All devices continue to be covered by our manufacturer's warranty and will receive full service support accordingly. And our most popular devices like the P30, the Mate 20, the P20, a lot of the Nova phones that were recently released, those are all going to receive Android Q. And the question is how? Like, the phones that have been released,
that's what matters.
will need to pass Google's compatibility test suite. And we're not sure after August 19th, and we're not sure that Android Q will be released before August 19th to the Pixel phones. So how the heck is Huawei going to roll out these updates to phones after August 19th unless they know something we don't? Maybe they're going to get another extension. Maybe this whole thing is going to be dropped by then. But it's unlikely that those two things are going to happen.
It sure seems like if they're going to make a statement like this, that they have to have some kind of a workaround slash loophole where they know, you know, they're being told, okay, we can, like, we can shoehorn you in, we can streamline this and, like, backdate some sort of, CTS certification to before this date. I mean, I would not be surprised if this current extension is extended again. Just
like Brexit, just indefinitely.
Yeah, just keep doing it over and over and over
again. The end of time.
I would not be surprised if they do that and they add a couple more months or another 6 months or whatever, just because it happened so quickly and easily the first time where everybody freaked out and then they just had this extension and then everything just kind of chilled for a moment. I would not be surprised if that happens again, but they can't be just counting on that in order to make some kind of statement like this. I'm like, they obviously are confident enough that they can, but this is something, and this is something that they love to be able to do because this is a big question that a lot of people are asking. And honestly, I don't think it's going to fully, it's not going to reverse all of the negative connotations of being worried about updates with a Huawei phone right now. But it seems like they have on the back end just struck a deal with Google some way, somehow, to know that they can check the box and say that it's done before this, you know, that point. The only question is, like, sure, it's cool that we would get Android Q, but, you know, if you buy a P30 Pro, you're expecting more than just one update to Android Q and that's it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's obviously, you know, also a thing, but Huawei, as far as I know, has never updated its phones beyond one platform update. And this whole update thing is relatively new to the company anyway. If, we're going back even to the Mate 10, P10, Mate 10, like, they only received one platform update.
Yeah.
And the update that they received did not look like the update of its successor. They did the Samsung thing they're still doing the Samsung thing to some extent where, you know, EMUI 8 on the P10 would not look like EMUI 8 on the P20 because they were kind of holding those experiences back. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to be the case going forward. I do know that with the with the P20, that update to Android P did get the same look and feel of the latest, you know, phones. So I think Huawei is doing a better job in general, but just anecdotally, like my wife's aunt went into a Vodafone store here in Turkey. Huawei is the company in Turkey. Like, they're, if you think about the brands that are pervasive in a country like Turkey, which is, you know, still considered a developing market, but there's a growing middle class and people can afford decent phones, Huawei is the brand that people seek. It's not necessarily Samsung. And, you know, to that extent, she was actually warned by a Vodafone employee, don't buy a Huawei phone right now. Instead, buy a Samsung, buy an Oppo. The new Oppo Reno, just, you know, as an aside, is being plastered on every single bus shelter in Istanbul. It's kind of crazy because it's just not a brand that you see in North America at all. But Huawei, Samsung, Oppo, there's a General Mobile brand here that is pretty major because it's a homegrown company. But they were like, don't buy a Huawei phone. It's not safe right now. Just buy a Samsung. It's as good. And she asked me if that's true. And I said, well, you know, I don't think it's a big deal if you buy a Huawei phone. But at the same time, you know, better safe than sorry.
Yeah, and I mean, this is something that we've been discussing internally as well, is when do you know, you know, the right time to switch and stop recommending these things, when you expect, like I was talking about earlier, that they're just going to probably extend and extend and extend until something is struck, and then it'll be different in the end, but it's not going to be substantially different or be a situation where, you know, the phone stops working. Like, that was the immediate reaction. And that's why it's very surprising to hear somebody in a store I mean, I guess they're just trying to help themselves out from a future customer service situation, you know, down the road of having to deal with somebody that's upset about their phone not working properly.
I mean, just like as another sort of thing that happened today, we're recording this on Friday, June 21st. Our friends at PC Mag, you know, our friend Sasha Sagan, he, one of his UK colleagues tried to send him a P30 Pro using FedEx. And apparently FedEx returned the package to the sender saying that they refuse to ship Huawei phones right now. So
that is insane.
If that is the case, like if they actually have an internal policy, because you're supposed to, you're actually supposed to say what brand of phone you're sending if it has a lithium ion battery. I mean, wow, like, come on. It's not like
that is,
it's not like you're sending a Note 7. Like, what the hell?
I don't understand that because that has no, like, that has nothing to do with the ban either. Because there's nothing to do with the transaction or, you know, import and export of it.
I don't know. It's weird. So, I mean, there's a lot of shenanigans happening with Huawei right now, but at the end of the day, I don't have that much faith that this company is going to be in good standing in a year from now. I mean, good standing, obviously, like the company will still be very successful. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, they're anticipating up to 60 million smartphone shortfall, between 40 and 60 million units compared to the previous year. And
they were expecting to sell somewhere in the low 200 million range, right?
Yeah, they were expecting to better their 2018 by a significant margin. And that will not happen based on their projections. So, yikes indeed. But moving on, because there are two big topics to talk about that I want to get to. But first things first. So you reviewed this new Galaxy Fit from Samsung. And what's weird is that this was announced at the same time as the Galaxy S10 and the Galaxy Watch Active. The Watch Active shipped like in March, basically, like right after the S10.
It was like a few weeks later.
Right. And then this one is shipping in May. Like, I'm not really sure what's up with that.
I don't understand it either because it's an extremely simple device. It has a tiny bit of RAM and has a tiny bit of storage and a real-time OS. It doesn't even run Tizen. It's who knows? I can't imagine that they have some kind of advanced components in here that they were struggling with. And considering how many wearables Samsung ships over the last, you know, 5 years, it's really baffling. I have no idea, especially when there's likely a lot shared between it and the Galaxy Watch Active. But anyway, they just rolled it out with no fanfare, of course, because after announcing it 4 months ago, you can't really do that. The nice thing is it's just on sale and you can just buy it. There's no pre-order period or anything like that. And I think you actually should for $100. I mean, this thing, that's also the weirdest thing is it's inexpensive and it's a real like low thought process, impulse buy kind of a product, just like all the other fitness trackers in the $100-ish range. And so that's even more surprising. There's not really going to be any marketing or anything made of this from Samsung's side.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a Fitbit competitor. Like there's very little,
it's an Inspire HR competitor just directly.
Yeah. I mean, it's $100. It takes on the $100 Inspire HR. It has basically the same feature set. It's a bit better on the technology side, obviously, because it's Samsung. Like, it's a color screen. It's got a few more bells and whistles, but it lacks all of the institutional health knowledge of a company like Fitbit. And that's something that would play into whether I bought it.
And that's basically what I came down to in my review is, and we've done some comparisons as well, if you have no prior, like if you haven't had a Fitbit before, or, you know, this is your first fitness tracker type thing, yeah, it's going to be fine. It does all of the things that you need in terms of a daily tracker goes. And the interesting thing is that I can actually give Samsung Health and their overall fitness tracking program a little bit more of a pass in this type of device than in the higher powered, more fully featured watches, where we've seen like issues with GPS and issues with heart rate tracking during intense workouts and things like that, because that's not what this is for anyway. It doesn't have GPS. It's not purporting to do any kind of crazy tracking. It really is like steps, regular but not continuous. I mean, you can turn on continuous heart rate if you really want to, but it's all about just steps, sleep. You can track a couple simple things in Samsung Health, and that's it. And that's kind of what people want when they buy one of these things anyway. So it's kind of easier to give it a pass. And so if you're not in the Fitbit ecosystem already, which is definitely a draw, then yeah, I mean, you might as well give it a go. And I think that the hardware is nicer and the screen is definitely nicer.
Yeah, I mean, that was true of the Gear Fit 2 Pro and the Pro. It was true of basically every Samsung wearable to date. Like, the hardware is unimpeachable. And it always gets criticized for inaccurate tracking, for kind of lack, like they just have a heavy hand when it comes to its health features in general. And Samsung Fit has been, or Samsung Health rather, has been improved dramatically over the last 3 years. Like, from its inception till now, it's a completely different and much more enjoyable, much more reliable and robust product. But like, Samsung always gets criticized for inaccurate sleep and step tracking. And, you know, so does Fitbit, to be fair. But I would personally have a bit more patience or more of a tendency to believe that the metrics that I get from a Fitbit than I would from a Samsung product. But at the same time, unless you're a really intense athlete, it's probably doesn't matter, like a couple thousand steps here or there.
No, it's all about the consistency of using the same thing day in and day out and getting the day over day, week over week, month over month change using the same device, then, you know, the difference in a couple percent here and there. I think that the one telling thing is that you see a lot of people that are using their third or fourth Fitbit, and you really don't see people that are just espousing their love for their third Samsung fitness tracker. And part of that is that Samsung just creates a different thing every single time. It tries something entirely new every time. It's like, it's a smartwatch. No, it's kind of this fitness band, but it does all the smartwatch things. And then now they're doing a really basic watch that has fitness tracker things and just the basic fitness tracker. Like, the only time we got a true successor was the Gear Fit and Fit 2. And then they didn't make a third one.
Yeah, I mean, those were pretty good products, but I also think
they're great products. Yeah. It's just interesting that they didn't actually follow it up and they just mixed the strategy every time.
What's so funny is that, like, the Samsung wearable strategy makes no sense. Like, if you go back to the original Galaxy Gear, it makes no sense at all. And yet somehow it works. And it works kind of because the hardware is way better than anything you'd get with Android Wear or Wear OS. Like, it just, from the rotating bezel to the quality of the hardware to the speed of Tizen, it just all feels so much more coherent. And it's the only Apple Watch competitor on the Android side that even comes close. And that's really the only reason that people are into these products, because they're not objectively amazing products. They have no apps to speak of. The apps that are on Tizen haven't been updated for years. I mean, you still get like Flipboard. Like, Flipboard is the one that they show you as the flagship app that you know should use on this thing. But somehow, like, it doesn't really matter, because it's a great it's a great feeling watch. I don't know. I like the Galaxy Watch Active so much that I'm willing to forgive any foibles in its software because it's just a really great feeling watch.
Yeah, and the you don't have to worry about any of the extra stuff on something as simple as the Galaxy Fit or even the Gear Fit 2 Pro. It, like, you don't have to worry about the fact that it doesn't have the apps or whatever because it doesn't run apps anyway. So Samsung is really good at making that single standalone product work really well. It just doesn't have as much of that ecosystem stuff, and that's the only shortcoming. And you can look past it on some of their products.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, going back to the Galaxy Fit, like, this thing will be... It's just a throwaway purchase. Like, it's $100 if you're looking for a Fitbit and you like Samsung stuff, you're gonna buy it. And honestly, that's exactly what they want. At the same time, it's probably also gonna get bundled in a ton of Samsung phones and other, you know, Samsung accessories. So you know this thing is just gonna fly off the shelves whether people actually realize it or not.
Yeah, it's not going to be $100 for long. That's for sure. No,
that's true. I mean, the Samsung loves to bundle. You could, when you pre-ordered the Galaxy S10, I think you were getting a Galaxy Watch Active with it. You were getting what else? What are the Galaxy Buds? Like, they were giving their new accessories away.
Giving away $400 in accessories.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, I reviewed the Withings Move this week, and it's kind of the complete opposite of a product. And I like it, I think, just as much as you liked the other one. So on your side, you have like a very, you know, you call it a traditional fitness tracker. On this side, you have a traditional watch that has a couple of, you know, pieces of intelligence in it. It's $70. It kind of looks like a Swatch if you squint. Mm-hmm. It comes in a bunch of different really neon colors. I'm using it's got a white face with a black body and like a mint green strap, which is just garish as all hell.
I like how the little extra hand in the face matches the strap though. That's neat.
Yeah. And they've done that for all of them. And in fact, you can build your own, or you will soon be able to build your own version of this. So they're debuting this crazy, like, Build-A-Bear type of watch scenario, and you'll pay like an extra $10 or $15 for it, but they'll ship you like a completely unique version of your Withings Move. And it's great. I mean, I really like this thing. There's no heart rate monitor. There's no screen to speak of, but you change the battery every 18 months, and yet it syncs behind the scene to your phone every day with your steps. It's waterproof. You can manually set, workouts, or if you want, it'll just automatically detect runs, swims, and bike rides based on your, the unique movements in your arms.
Hmm.
And like, it's cheap and cheerful. Like, if people are asking me, hey, I want to watch, but I also want to track my steps, this is immediately going to be the product that I recommend.
It reminds me a ton of what Fossil was trying to do and is still doing kind of, for a few years now, where you make a simple mechanical watch and you just add in the smarts that just kind of happen in the background. I think the difference there and why it doesn't work as well as it does with this Withings Move is that those were still more expensive devices. They weren't the kind of watch that was designed or priced in a way that you would throw it on every day as kind of your daily watch, like you would want for something that's actively tracking your movements. And that makes this so much more attractive at $70. Like, that's the kind of price that most people are going to spend on, you know, like you said, a cheap Swatch style watch to wear every day. And, you know, you're going to bash it up a little bit and that's fine. And you're going to buy another one when this one breaks or looks a little tired. It's not like this special purchase of $400 and you're worried about it, and but also you need to wear it every day so that you track your steps. And that's how, like, this is the type of thing that can break people of the dual wrist problem of having the fitness tracker on one and the watch on the other, which still just looks funny.
Exactly. And I also, you know, I'm seeing this, at least within like our nerdy community, but also at large. Like, there was a trend in the last 5 years towards, I have to have a smart device on my wrist. And we sort of, you know, that ebb has flowed. And we're now kind of coming back to this notion that, like, we really don't need a smartwatch, first of all, unless it's an Apple Watch. People will never take those off. And if you do want a watch, a lot of people are just kind of, they just don't want to charge something every night. They just want something that they can either not wear to bed or wear to bed, but not even have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's also an important point. And that's something I didn't mention about the Galaxy Fit. This thing pushes like 10 days of battery life, which is already amazing for something that's tracking so much and not, you don't have to care about battery life at all, but not having to charge it at all or, you know, totally. Worry about it for months is amazing.
Like, this has a CR2052 like watch cell. Like, you literally just go to your local watch store and they will replace it in 5 seconds.
That's fantastic. So,
yeah, I mean, I highly recommend this. There's also an ECG version coming out in the next couple of weeks where it doesn't do anything else, but it'll, you know, it adds the feature to allow you to, you know, check to see whether you have AFib. And that's cool because it's going to be like a $90 or $100 product that checks for AFib. Very few products that at that price range does it, does that. So, I like it. I'm not sure what colors people are going to be into, but there's, like, if you're not into garish colors, there's a black one too. So
anyway, they look fun and playful.
Yeah, exactly. That's about all we can say about that. All right. We'll take a quick break and, we will return shortly. Hey, this week's episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Thrifter. So we are gearing up for Prime Day. This is Amazon's big sale of the year. And every year, Thrifter is the place to go for all of the best deals as they come in. I mean, literally as they come in. If you are interested in saving money at all this summer and you follow Prime Day, you need to subscribe to Thrifter's newsletter. They're going to be doing these blasts throughout the Prime Day week. I mean, it's not a day anymore. It's now a week. But you will get the best deals as they come in. All these lightning deals that last minutes, you'll be the first ones to know. And overall, Thrifter is just the best place to find deals in general. It means finding a pair of $100 headphones for $50. It means getting deals on Nintendo Switch games or saving money on iPads. It means getting the latest Dyson animal vacuum cleaners for like 70% off. These are things that rarely go on sale, but Thrifter finds the deals for you when they do. So if you're interested, head to thrifter.com or follow them on Thrifter on Twitter at Thrifter Daily, and then sign up for their newsletter. You will not regret it. Whew, okay, we are running through these topics, Andrew, but we have two more to go, and they are doozies with capital D's. So the first one is that yesterday, it kind of came out of the blue, but Computer World, our friend J.R. Raphael, had a scoop that he learned that Google is out of the tablet game. Like, they're just done. They are not going to make any more tablets. They are not making a follow-up to the Pixel Slate. They are out. And then they also said that they would most likely follow up with a Pixel Book successor in 2019, which is really good news because it wasn't updated last year for obvious reasons. And then the man himself, Rick Osterloh, literally like scooped the leak again. Yeah. Because why not? Google's on a roll here. And basically said that that's true. We are no longer in the tablet game, but rest assured that we are committed to our partners when it comes to Android and Chrome OS tablets. So that is a lot to unpack here. So let's start from the beginning. No more Google tablets. What does that mean?
Hooray, because all their tablets since the Nexus 7 have been compromised and not great. It doesn't really come as a massive surprise when we had, first of all, because the tablets being bad part, but the general Android tablets being bad part also, the Chrome OS as a tablet operating system not making sense part. And then we had had this previous rumor back in March where it was said that there were some tablets that were in the works, like a medium size and a small size tablet that got canned. And those people that were working on those tablets were, said, okay, well, this isn't going to be replaced with another tablet. You're going to work on laptops in the Google hardware division. And so the writing continued to kind of be added to the wall when they, of course, when the Pixel Slate came out and it was not fantastic. And then they cut back on models and, all these different little things. You're like, why are they continuing to just like bash their heads into a wall about tablets and this weird dual tablet strategy of having, you know, the Android tablets and the Chrome OS tablets? It just didn't make a whole lot of sense anyway. The interesting part is Rick Osterloh being, just confirming it. Be like, yeah, we're no more rumors. Like, we're actually just not making tablets anymore. And the crazy part there is like, if Google is just going to come up and straight up say, like, yeah, tablets just don't work for us with Android or Chrome OS. Oh, but we're happy to have our partners make them. It's like, if you're one of these partners, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's so on the one hand, this is sort of the Microsoft conundrum. And it goes to show just A, how difficult it is to design hardware that makes sense for a mainstream audience, right? The Pixel Slate was a cautionary tale in a number of ways, right? They released four different models. One of them never got released, or two of them never really got released. And they went all the way from like $600, which is the one that didn't get released because its hardware was just too damn slow to run Chrome, all the way to like $1,600 for a tablet that you had to pay extra for a keyboard.
Yeah, I don't think that there was as it wasn't so much that the product itself was not like well designed or the hardware wasn't well done. It was just that the value proposition was not at all there, considering the price and what was being offered and the operating systems just not being up to speed. I mean, this was the case all the way at the Pixel C.
So absolutely. I mean, we heard rumors that the Pixel C was supposed to be a Chrome device and it wasn't ready at the time. And then there was no follow-up to that for a couple of years. And then here we get the Pixel Slate. And, it made sense at the time that Google would not build its own Android-based tablet anymore. Android tablets have been languishing for years. It's no secret. I mean, two companies basically build Android tablets, Samsung and Huawei. The rest of the Android tablets are either using forked versions of Android or they're these like cheapy Walmart branded crap tablets that nobody should buy. So putting Chrome on it made sense, but this enormous cloud of whether Google could make Chrome into a touch-friendly OS was hanging over that release from the moment we demoed it in October. Mm-hmm. And it got delayed and it got delayed and eventually it gets released. And even though we reviewed the tablet on the second most powerful SKU, which was a Core i5 with plenty of RAM. This shouldn't have any problem running Chrome. And yet it chugged and it was awkward and it didn't make sense.
Yeah.
The way that you interacted with it from a tablet to a laptop. And the whole thing just felt unfinished in a way that the Pixelbook never did. And I just don't know how this ever passed Google's quality control.
Well, yeah, I don't understand how it did either. But that's the crazy part, is that the Pixelbook is so good as a laptop. You know, it's obviously a super thin and light and well-designed one, but you do have the extra affordances of it being an actual laptop with laptop internals, not trying to pull this double duty thing with all the thermal constriction restrictions of the Pixel Slate. But it is just crazy that the same, not the same exact people per se, but the same group could make the Pixelbook so great and then make the Pixel Slate be such a trying to be charitable, just not good product.
So, I mean, on the one hand, like you said, the Pixel Book was this, like, it's miraculous how fantastic this product is. But it's also, you know, it's a 2-in-1. You can turn that keyboard around and use it as a tablet. Nobody really does that. But the way that Google tried to address the tablet problem for Chrome OS was to build this tablet only interface where it's sort of, it was like this hybrid between an iPad and like a full desktop, where you have you can like drag and drop between windows, you have this sort of pinch out view, you have these affordances that make touch targets bigger, things like that. But even today in June 2019, with how many, like, they update Chrome every 6 weeks. So, you know, like a half dozen, or 4 or 5 major updates to Chrome, they still haven't fixed the bulk of the performance issues. And This is like, even our, even like Jerry, who loves Chrome and who's very, very forgiving of a product like the Pixelbook or Pixel Slate, is not going to go out of his way to compliment Google's, you know, touch changes for the OS.
Yeah, that's the craziest thing, is that you can have problems with the way that the interface works and not having that kind of tablet touch only paradigm set up properly, but the performance problems are inexcusable. I mean, you can have interface issues and not be able to handle window management properly. Like, those are really tough things and something you would expect in the transition from a desktop style operating system to a tablet one. But not being able to run smoothly is not something that should be excused. And if this really was like, top people put this thing together and this was the result, then yeah, maybe they shouldn't make tablets anymore.
But I mean, on a higher level, we're also talking about the hardware group and the software group are not the same people. And even though Google is no longer making tablets, it's not going to stop optimizing Chrome for the tablet form factor, because we still have companies like HP, like Dell, like Asus building Chromebooks, and we know that they're going to try to make the Chrome tablet a thing. So, you know, let's kind of take a step back for a second and think, is now Google going to invest its resources that they couldn't get for its own product into a product for its partners? And this is, you know, Dieter Bohn from The Verge had an editorial today where he sort of like laid it out in a way that I think makes a lot of sense. He said that, you know, when Google invests fully in something, they do it right. I mean, Android, they have improved Android to the point where it is basically the best mobile operating system in the world. I as somebody who came to this job largely using an iPhone for most things, I prefer using Android today. It is objectively, in my opinion, a better operating system. They never did that with Chrome on Touch. I think Chrome OS still has some growing pains from a laptop perspective, but by and large, you can use Chrome for your daily, you know, workload, no problems. But you know, they just kind of gave up when it came to this, you know, this paradigm shift. And I think they did the same thing with Wear OS. They have not mm-hmm. fully invested in making this a thing. And if you don't invest fully, it's basically dead.
And the interesting thing there is that this discussion of we won't do it, but partners can do it is just not going to work. If Google presumably put a lot of work into these tablets over several years. Okay, you can be quiet, phone, listening to me. If it put all of these resources into making tablets and it couldn't make it happen, there's no incentive or structure in place expecting the other companies to do a better job. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It doesn't align with what you would expect. You want Google to be able to show you how it's done. And up to this point, they haven't. That's the crazy thing. Other than the high-end Chromebooks, which, you know, is out of the tablet sphere entirely, they haven't shown how it's done. For as bad as Android tablets are, the best ones have not been Google's. They've been coming from other companies like Samsung.
Right. So, you know, I think there's also something to be said for, like, you know, I want to give Google the benefit of the doubt here. You know, as big a company as it is, they don't have a long legacy of hardware. And maybe it just comes down to the fact that they were spreading themselves too thin, building too many different types of products, and that they wanted to be able to focus on the form factors that their specific hardware team could do right. And you know, I want to, again, continue giving them the benefit of the doubt by saying that even though they are no longer building hardware, like tablet hardware internally, that does not mean that they're putting any less emphasis on optimizing Chrome for touch. That may not be true, but I don't think there is...
But it's not a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign at all. And in fact, I'm 99% sure that Rick Osterloh did not want to have to come out and say this. He wanted, in October, when the Pixel 4 is announced, to announce the new Pixel Book next to it. And they would just never mention tablets again. You know, the way that they stopped mentioning tablets after the Pixel C. And yep. That was just the way that they were going to do it. And the Pixel slate would eventually get discontinued and fade into the distance or be sold at a huge discount until inventory was depleted. And that would be it. But that's not the way it worked. And I think he felt that, or maybe his handlers felt, that it was easier and better for them to get out ahead of this and reassure companies like Lenovo and HP and Dell that they weren't abandoning Chrome from a software perspective, because they can't. I mean, these companies rely on Google improving Chrome to sell their hardware the way that they rely on Microsoft, who is now even a competitor with the Surface line, to improve Windows independently of the Surface, you know, the Surface Book and the Surface Pro.
Yeah, it would definitely be in Google's best interest to continue to develop some sort of tablet operating system interface, whatever you want to call it, whether that's Android, whether that's Chrome, it seems like it's more likely the latter. But it's just the optics of the situation of confirming that they can't do it or won't do it themselves from the hardware perspective, that it doesn't really matter how much reassurance they give to a partner. It's just not the best sign. And it just adds to the general, there's just already this general feeling that Google just can't figure out tablets. And so even if you are just plowing money into this thing and trying to make something work, you have to say that there's some upside of having that happen and just having the knowledge that Google is trying.
100% true. And like my concern here is, you know, with Google now focusing on laptops, obviously every laptop Google builds from now on will be touch optimized. There's going to be this sense that nobody else is going to be able to take, nothing else is going to be able to take on the iPad. Because for some reason, the way that the industry has sort of structured itself is that the builders of the platforms are now all hardware builders. That is just a thing that has happened, right? Where Microsoft decided in 2012 to start building Surface tablets so that it could showcase the way that it wants Windows to be on a tablet interface. And the Pixel Slate was that representation from Google. And now it's sort of going to have to leave that open to interpretation from its partners like Lenovo and Dell and HP. And even though we know that they're not allowed to change the way that Chrome works, it's still kind of weird that if Google comes on stage at some, you know, future date, or it's on, you know, stage at I/O, and it's like, hey, we have all these brand new Chrome on tablet features to show off, they're probably not going to show a Pixel Slate in 2021 or 2022. They're going to show an HP X2 2021 or 2022.
Right. You know
I'm saying, like, it's just a weird, it's I don't know, it's this like weird contrast that I don't, you're right, it just does not instill confidence.
Yeah, and it's already coming at a time when the partners are continuing to make devices, but as you pointed out, they're not exactly the most amazing devices, nor are they coming out at a regular cadence or with anything particularly interesting, because you know they see a very small part of the market to be able to sell to. They see Google not making a lot of big strides, and they're saying, well, it, you know, as Samsung, for example, or Lenovo, what are we going to do? Are we going to go out of our way to make all these changes and start to build our own, you know, like Samsung has done effectively with like the DeX desktop mode on an Android tablet? You know, why are they going to go through that if they don't feel like there's a long road ahead for tablet apps or operating systems?
And I mean, that comes back to the, you know, you mentioned tablet apps, like Chrome on tablets was already this weird hybrid, because you could run tablet or Android apps. You could also run Chrome apps on there. Some of it was really optimized for touch. Some of it really isn't. You know, mm-hmm. Typing, for example, on a Chrome tablet without a keyboard is still kind of a hassle. You know, yes, there has been iteration, but you see Apple like so far ahead, and maybe that was it, right? Maybe it was just that Google's hardware division was like, we could make Chrome OS on tablets as good as it will, you know, ever be. There is no way we're going to sell enough hardware to make a profit. So why even bother? And that's, I think, a big consideration, because they're not really profitable from a hardware perspective yet. We know this. So why sink further money into this R&D when we know that Chrome's future is in software, and that they're going to have to, you know, that let their hardware partners bear the brunt of that liability by building hardware?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, is that they just don't want to bleed money anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know that. It's just sometimes you have to say that it's a strategic loss for the greater good of the platform. But, you know, at this point, maybe the scale is tipped too far. It can't come back.
Yeah, I mean, the other part of that argument is we know that the Pixel phone line hasn't really sold all that well, may not have even made a profit, probably hasn't. And yet there's no question that Google is continuing to invest in the Pixel phones for the, you know, foreseeable future. Like I don't see a time in the next 10 years, I'm going to throw this out there, maybe it'll hurt me in the long run, but I don't see a time in the next 10 years that Google does not make a Pixel phone annually. So
yeah,
it's just that it's so obviously important,
so locked in
to Google, right? They spent millions of dollars getting HTC employees. They've opened new offices in Taiwan. They are now completely independent from a design perspective. It just does. I cannot foresee a time where they're not going to build their own phone. It's like you just have to. You have this confidence, and yet on the non-phone hardware side, you just don't have that confidence.
It's just like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I mean, the only other area you can say that would be the case is some sort of Google Home and some sort of Chromecast device.
Yeah, I mean,
but not necessarily the Google Home and Chromecast as we know it.
True, but like here's the interesting thing, right? Is that like they have not released a new Google Home speaker, like the standalone OG Google Home since 2016, right? It's been a variation of that form factor ever since. And I know that the replacement rate for these things is not nearly as high as a phone, so that makes sense.
Nor does it need to be.
No, but it's interesting that they're not like going out of their way to iterate on that original form factor. They're continuing to see what the market wants. And right now, obviously, the market wants a screen. So they released the Nest Hub or the Google Home Hub, whatever it's called these days. The Google Nest Hub Max is coming out in a few weeks, which is this like, it basically amalgamates every bit of smart device hardware prowess that Google has and that they took from Nest. Like it's like mm-hmm. they've taken the kitchen sink and they've thrown this in here. And to me, that speaks to, and I have no doubt that this is going to be a good device because we know from the other Google Home products that they're all, I mean, they're kind of perfect. Like I don't want to blow too much smoke up Google's ass here, but like I've been using the Google Home Hub for the last few weeks because it came out late in Canada. It's kind of perfect for what it is.
And they don't, I mean, we've talked about this so many different ways, but you don't have to really add anything. Like when we're still just on the very leading edge of these types of products. And so we don't know what we don't have, and we don't know necessarily what's possible that we don't have. And so when you're leading the market, why is it going to come out and release something new to replace it? It doesn't have to happen.
True. And I mean, yeah, it's also like the number of competitors is much fewer. I mean, you're basically only competing with Amazon here rather than like every other tablet and PC maker in the world. So it's
a different situation when you're an undeniable leader in that market versus tablets.
Oh, I mean, you're not a leader. Like Google is, I think the last stat was like 30-ish% versus 60-ish% from Amazon. But like,
sure.
Still, who else is you're not competing with Cortana. You know, you're not competing with like the HomePod. Like the HomePod is enough. Like, it's so interesting to see the difference in public perception between phones, tablets, and like these new smart home products. Google and Amazon are so far ahead of Apple in this respect. It's not even worth considering them in the conversation most of the time. And yet when you talk about tablets, the iPad is the only tablet. It just, there's nothing else. So it's very strange.
Strange is right. Google's hardware strategy summed up in one word: strange.
Yeah. So let's talk something else that Google's doing that's kind of strange, but potentially very interesting and cool. And if you're drinking, whenever I say the word interesting, I think that's like number six now. So tell us about what happened this week with RCS and Google kind of being badass and taking a stand.
Yeah, this is at once exactly what we wanted to see from the start and also something that you can see ending up going very badly. So RCS is this rich communication services, this next generation of SMS messaging that offers rich communication. So it offers all of these extra things that we like to see in your over-the-top chat apps, but it's linked to your phone number and connected through the regular carrier network. And the thing about RCS was it required a partnership with carriers. So the only way to have partners on the phone side. So all of these messaging app makers, Samsung and LG and Motorola and Google that all bake, these messaging apps into their phones can update their phones to offer, compatibility with RCS. But the big hurdle was you also had to have carriers on board. Every single carrier had to be on board, and they announced all these partnerships and said, we have XYZ carrier, we have 50 carriers on board. And the only way that you could start to see RCS work was two people with updated phones, with updated carriers, and then it would start to work, but you didn't really know when. And obviously, as expected, that rollout is super, super slow. So Google just said, okay, we're going to stop waiting for the carriers and we're just going to force it to happen. And they're going to start doing this in the UK and France later on in June. And this is just kind of their trial balloon. And I appreciate it. I'm also questioning whether this will backfire, or I should say how this will backfire.
Yeah, I mean, I share your skepticism, but I also don't see how it could backfire. The way that it's been described is that they're going to defer to carriers if and when they sign up for RCS-UP. Like, an RCS-UP is universal profile. So the way that RCS was designed is that it's built on the SMS standard, and it allows for things like delivery receipts for higher quality videos and photos. You know, if you never want to see a 200 kilobyte MMS come through your inbox again, RCS is going to be your jam. Like, there's some really exciting things about it because it just lives in the same place as your regular text messages. But for years, carriers, especially in the US, had this notion that their implementation of RCS was the right one. And eventually the GSMA, the standards body behind RCS, was like, okay, screw it. We're going to design a single universal profile that everybody can adopt so that carriers around the world will just be able to talk to one another. It's basically like Esperanto, this like perfect neutral language that you all know. And if you don't know it, this universal translator will just, do the hard work for you. And I like that idea. The problem is that the carriers, especially in the US again, are all money grubbing a-holes who wanted to control the experience for customers. So Verizon had their Messages Plus app that would allow you to send ostensibly RCS messages to other Verizon customers, but along their unique highway. And it didn't communicate with T-Mobile or AT&T or Sprint. And for a very long time, Sprint was the only company, because what else did they have to do, to sign up for UP? And Google touted this partnership with Sprint for months and years, trying to entice the other three carriers to get on board. And that just never happened. So we're sitting here today with none of the major US carriers, because Sprint is not a major US carrier, working with RCS-UP. And that sucks. So like, Google had no choice. They're going to say, hey, we're going to do this for you. It's still an opt-in, so people have to say yes to the prompt.
And it's in Android messages.
Right. So but it's also in Samsung messages. We know that because Samsung signed on for UP last year.
Presumably, so, that would require some sort of an opt-in from their side, too.
I'd imagine, but Google probably had that in the bag long before this announcement was made.
Hmm.
Like, if they don't have Samsung on board, this whole thing doesn't work.
You're talking about an app update, too, not a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is definitely, like, the whole idea here is that you have to be using a compatible chat app. But if you're doing that, it should just work. Like, I've been I have two SIM cards. One of the SIMs that I have, the carrier signed up for UP. And, like, you just, when you put the SIM in, the app detects the change. It says, hey, you have, you're using a carrier that supports RCS Universal Profile. Let's sign you on to this. Do you agree to the terms and conditions? You say yes. And then if you're sending a message to somebody who also has the same set of, the same set of rules applied, then you'll just start getting higher quality photos, send and read receipts and things like that. You're right. Like, what's going to happen here? What's the catch? I don't know.
I mean, theoretically, it all just works fine. It works no different than WhatsApp does. You know, you authenticate with a phone number, you connect to a contact, and then you're just going from there. It's just, I just worry that something gets messed up along the line because, you know, the carriers control that part of the network. They control the base SMS system. And who knows, you know, I don't expect sabotage, but incompetence could certainly happen.
So on the other side of it, though, RCS is sort of touted as this iMessage savior for Android. But as we know, it's not exactly built that way.
No, can't get
for
that
starters,
carried away.
It's not end-to-end encrypted. So, you know, the whole idea here is that Google is facilitating the send and receive of these messages if the carrier does not actually have RCS infrastructure. If they do, the carrier can and probably is saving the metadata from your messages and legally can be forced to turn over your messages to the police. So that has been a major and I think, rightly so, a criticism of RCS since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And Google says that they are trying to build something on top of Universal Profile to enable end-to-end encryption. But I don't know what that would look like if the carriers can just step in and say, oh, okay, we'll take over from here. And then just, that's the kind of sabotage I'm seeing. Is that Google, you know, relents to the carriers because that's what they always do. And then the carriers just backtrack and say, well, you know, we're not really into that whole end-to-end encrypted thing. So we're just not going to do it.
I don't have as much of an issue with the discussion around encryption. I mean, because we're talking about an upgrade to SMS. And if you wanted encrypted chats, there are many ways to do that. And it's not that everybody doesn't deserve to have encrypted communications without the carrier or somebody else snooping on them. But it's more like we're not at the point where RCS is perfect and well deployed and we're up to the point where we can start nitpicking about whether it has encryption. It's like, no, RCS is still a complete shit show and nobody can really use it consistently or knows what it is. And so maybe we should get over that first hurdle before we start complaining about features it doesn't have.
Totally. I mean, and that's true of the next thing that it's been criticized for, which is that it still, like WhatsApp, relies on a phone number. So there's only one instance, unlike iMessage, and it's not really you can't consider it like a cross-platform messenger in the same way that you can of, say, Hangouts or even iMessage, because iMessage is now synced over the cloud. It's built in such a way that ostensibly you can just use it anywhere you want and all of your messages will send to the right person and sync accordingly. It doesn't always happen, because Apple still can't solve that problem for everybody and in every situation. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this is like, if your phone is in your hand, the messages you send from that phone are not anywhere else. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's still a limit, a limitation that people have to keep in mind.
I just think that it's such a, we're still just so far, even with Google pushing this really hard and trying to make it happen, we're just still so far from propagation of this or people understanding even what's going on that it's just hard to get too worked up about it.
I agree. I'm excited about it because I send a lot of text messages and it's just, it's something that I would really like to see. I mean, the other side of it too, is that if Apple doesn't sign up and allow RCS on its phones, then you're kind of only talking to 45% of the smartphone population in North America, maybe less.
Well, like, and it's not even 45% because, like, this doesn't solve the problem that's just a societal problem. Google can't fix this, is that everybody uses different chat apps and there's, of course, overlap in all of those circles in that Venn diagram. But it's not like every Android user is using SMS only. It's true. Like, yeah, it falls back as a default, but it's like there are also people on Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp and Signal and Telegram and WeChat and a million other apps. So it's good to see that the base, like as a default, when you have somebody's phone number, you know you can send them a text message and it'll get there. Having that be elevated to a higher level is great, but it doesn't mean that everybody's just going to flock back to SMS and RCS anyway, because there's all this infrastructure behind all of these other apps that people are using. So it's just one more card in the deck. It's not necessarily, you know, it's not like the future of messaging is hinging on RCS and we'll all fall into line with it as soon as it's ready to go.
I see what you're saying, but I do think that, you know, there is some heightened language that RCS deserves. And if only because the second you introduce this sort of this level playing field with iMessage at a base level, right, where, you know, in an ideal world where, yes, there are competitors like WhatsApp and whatever. In an ideal world, if you can take for granted that regardless of what, you know, of who you're talking to, you get send and receive receipts, you get high quality images, you get, you know, much, much faster transit. You just get the core features of a good, solid messenger all the time. Like, that's the thing is, SMS is just such a downgrade compared to everything else.
Oh yeah, it's horrible. I understand. Elevating that level to get it closer to all these chat apps that we love is great.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hoping for, is that we can just like get a baseline of adequate for every single type of communication. Because as an Android user, I just feel like whenever I have to send a text message, it's just like eating sand. It's so uncomfortable because it's bad. Mm-hmm. It's just a bad experience. And, you know, for most Android users, it's like you don't have iMessage, so it's the path of least resistance. And for me, increasingly, that's Instagram, because all of my actual friends are on Instagram now. They're not on Facebook, and I don't use Facebook Messenger as much as I used to. So I send people Instagram DMs, and that is a pretty bad experience. But I know that it's the app that most people are opening the most often, and that if I need to get in touch with somebody, I can get them there. And I kind of don't want that. So the fewer Facebook-owned chat platforms that I have to engage with on a daily basis, the better.
Of course, there's something romantic about having the decentralized, you know, not owned by anyone standard. You know, that's pretty great. We could all go back to sending emails if we want. IMAP forever.
So does this bring us into an hour-long conversation on Libra and the decentralized blockchain-based payment fiat currency?
I would prefer if it didn't. Greatly.
Yeah, I think we can skip Libra. if you do want to hear about Libra, I bet you there are so many good podcasts this week all about that. Because that was insane news that I would love to... here's the homework. If you are listening to other podcasts, which I hope you are, because our podcast is great, but it's very, very niche, tell me which ones are explaining Libra the best, because I really want to learn about it through podcasts this week. I don't want to have to read another 10,000-word treatise from Josh Constein at TechCrunch, because that was the only one about Libra that I read, and my goodness. It was no, don't get me wrong.
Do not blame
you. It was well
reported
and like well researched, but just like it's so dry. I want somebody to explain this to me in like regular English. All right. So I think we have completed our show notes, and we have 10 minutes to spare between our normal show running time. So
not bad. We kept that to a tight hour and a half. It's really good.
You get to go and enjoy your weekend now. What are you up to?
I absolutely will. Well, weather permitting, we're going to go spend some time on the beach and have some Mexican lager and sit on the beach and the typical stuff thereafter.
Nice. I'm actually also going to sit on the beach this weekend.
Slightly different sea.
The Aegean Sea, which is really pretty, very clear, and very calm, actually. It's nice to be on... the sand is a little bit rough, like the beaches themselves are not as nice as some of the other ones. That sounds very pretentious, I'm sorry. But the seawater here is stunning. If you ever want to, you know, a nice vacation, come to the west coast of Turkey. So, I'll end it here by saying that traveling, doing a working trip for 5 weeks is very tough. It's also very fun and very challenging. Traveling with a baby is also very tough and fun. But, you know, I highly recommend that everybody does this. It's been such an eye-opening experience about just like getting away from the things that you're comfortable with. You know, there are so many daily amenities that I took for granted, like warm showers. Oh my God, I would kill for a warm shower right now. I'm staying in a place that has barely trickling showers and there's no hot water. But, you know, it really does sort of give you some perspective. And I'm hoping to share some of it in an essay that I'm writing over the weekend as part of the Editor's Desk
Amazing.
Series that we're running. But yeah, I mean, I'm having such a good time. And like the lows are really low, like when I'm just like dejected from like how disgustingly hot and tired and sweaty and gross everything is. I just want to be home in my bed with air conditioning. But the highs are amazing. Like the food in Turkey is insanely good. The beaches are beautiful. The people are lovely and generous and warm and just, oh, they will do anything for you. And yeah, I mean, just being able to introduce my daughter to my wife's family who all live in Turkey, that's the reason we're here. It's been remarkable, man. I'm really happy to have given her this experience and also to be able to experience this myself.
I'm very glad the trip can be that long as well. It's not just an in and out. You get the true experience.
Well,
and so does your wife and daughter.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously just because, I mean, there's two reasons, really, that we can do this. The one is that Canada has amazing maternity leave. My wife gets a year off work, you know, which is basically unheard of in many other countries. So we're very lucky. And the other part is that I have a remote job where I can work anywhere with an internet connection. So, you know, we sort of, while my daughter is this young, like she's 10 months old now, it's important that, you know, we take this opportunity because it's probably never going to happen again. So glad we did it.
It's fantastic.
But I'm also kind of glad that I'll be going home in a week and a half because shower. all right. So that's it. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. This has been a bit of a different one, and I'm sorry if the sound quality for me is a little bit lower than what you're used to. But it should be all back to normal in a couple of weeks. And yeah, let me know what you thought. podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. And Andrew, thanks for hosting the last 2 weeks. You did a great job.
Yeah, no problem at all. But, you know, we want you back.
I'm back, baby. I'm back.
All right.
Sweaty, but I'm back. All right. We'll talk to everybody next week. Cheers.
Bye-bye.